This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Sanjeev Rai. He is coming to us from Mumbai. He is the founder, chairperson, chief solver, and chief architect of multiple companies. And he just knows a lot about a lot of things here. And a health tech company, including Genic AI, which has developed cures for SARS-CoV-2 and future-related strains of the virus. He also is working with NASA to help make possible permanent human inhabitants of outer planets. So this will be an interesting discussion. Sanjeev, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Jason. Well, after 4 years of being interested in our work, you know, you guys made sure that we come out of our media shyness and talk to you guys. So thank you so much. By the way, so we're not working with NASA. I delivered a project to NASA along with Princeton University when I was in the U.S. just for small correction.
Good stuff. And of course, for those of you who don't know Sanjeev's work, feel free to look him up, check out his Wikipedia entry. There is a lot there. But I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. And Sanjeev, just give us an overview, if you would, as to, you know, something you said to me before we started today was very interesting about what level of civilization we are. And, you know, there's all this talk and fear about, you know, AI and will it take over? Are we in danger? There's just a lot of discussion about these things, but there's actually a way to categorize what type of civilization we are, right? And what level we're at. Tell us about that.
So we are at a civilization level 0.8 at best from looking at different calculations from the level of, you know, technology and scientific preparedness that we see. It's an energy scale, and this is being classified by folks like Kardashev and Carl Sagan. We have 8 different levels of civilization, starting from what we do with self-sustainable planet, like, you know, our energy needs are going to be self-sustainable on the planet, and then we move on to become a space race, and that's when we become civilization 1.0. So it's a logarithmic scale, and then it goes up to scale 8.0, where we eventually become quantum information. And our consciousness goes through this journey from civilization 1.0 to 8.0.
Okay. The highest number is 8.0?
Yes, that's how the distinctions have broadly been made by Carl Sagan, based on the work of a previous scientist named Kardashev.
And you said Carl Sagan, right?
Yes.
Okay, just want to make sure I understood that correctly, and we're talking about the same thing. So we'll get into that, and we've got something at the end for that. But moving on here, tell us about your work with human longevity.
Well, on longevity, we have figured out 2 pathways that we discovered through work that, you know, that has lasted over 1.5 decades. And we think that there is a possibility to expand human life from anywhere between 150 years to 700 years. And these 2 pathways are microfluidics-based equilibrium pathways. I don't want to go into the scientific aspect of it, since you asked it to...
Well, just tell us in layperson's language, what does microfluidics mean? I mean, you know, is that cryogenics? Because I know there's always been this problem of, you know, when you freeze, can't unthaw. Is that what it's about?
Yeah, so microfluidics is more about the flow of energy throughout our system. So if you take our system as a biological system, the entire flow that happens through the different subsystems, so whether that flow is smooth and whether that flow goes in a way that we have an ability for the body to age either at a slower pace or at a level where we start making a constant equilibrium between our cell death and renewal of our cells. So our cells go through this entire process where around the age of 21, we start into a negative delta, which means that the rate of change of cell regeneration or new cells forming becomes less than the decay. So the cells actually start dying more than it regenerates around the age of 21. So the whole idea is how can we extend that period, that 21, to a longer period? So the graph going down could instead have a less steeper curve and more flattening of that curve as it flows.
So how do you pick 100? And I've always heard that started at like 30, you know, that we all start dying when we're about 30. But you say 21. So how do you pick those numbers of 150 years to 700 years? Where does that come from?
So there is a calculation based on the published statistics about the different aging patterns across the world based on different conditions, different lifestyle conditions. Then you go down to the DNA level, the RNA level, and then beyond the first principles to start looking at what is the rate of cell formation and the cell decays. And that rate is pretty much in the positive till about 21 years of our age. On an average, it depends person to person. It is not a specific range across everyone, but it depends on, you know, different population profiles, etc. But it definitely is up to, you know, 21 that we have a positive rate of cell growth, and then it starts decaying. And
right, therefore, right. But how do you get the calculation of 150 to 700 years? That's my question.
Yeah, so if you are able to flatten the curve, so if you visualize a curve where, you know, you start the whole aging process goes through a bell curve, like it has a peak, and then it starts into the deceleration path. Now, if you start flattening that curve, and that is something that you can do through some of these approaches, these two approaches that we have found, that, you know, through a proper microfluidics flowing through the body right up to the DNA level and beyond first principles at the molecular level, at the biophysics level, we get into those equilibrium, which we can start flattening further, which means that the rate at which the body regenerates its cells, it starts to extend beyond 21, and you age that out to, say, 30, 40, 50, 60, and therefore steepening of the curve starts beginning at that age, let's say 40, 50, 60, or even 70 years. And then slowly it starts falling down, and then by around 150, it reaches a stage where you have your body's systems giving up, like it gives up today at the age of 80 or 90 or 100.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's take this into your work with SARS and explain to us the naming convention of, you know, we're all talking about COVID-19, right? How does that come about? So the CO is coronavirus, is corona, and the V is virus, and then D is disease, or
correct.
And then
correct.
Why 19? What's the convention all about?
Okay, so it started in the year 2019, and WHO made this naming convention based on the CO representing coronavirus, corona, VI for virus and D for disease. And the SARS-CoV-2 is a name of the strain, which is the scientific name defined by taxonomy, the taxonomy group. And this SARS-CoV-2 means it's the coronavirus 2 of the SARS strain. The first one occurred in the year 2003.
So that was the first one. And then now, you know, we've got one back, obviously. Yeah, well, tell us about your work on this, if you would.
So we did a 360-degree analysis, which was very outcome-oriented. Very early on, when the data started getting reported, we published out a small, you know, note on LinkedIn on the 30th of Jan, you know, quote unquote, setting out a little alarm saying that this could become a very serious strain. We were probably one of the first ones to perhaps declare then, so far as we know. And we started to raise all the flags to all the top government officials, etc. We sent the information to the health secretary as well in the US and right up to the prime minister's office in India. And we tried to raise that awareness, and then we started working on it.
When was this?
This was January 30th. And then in about February 1st week is when we sent out these emails marking urgent. And then we've been constantly trying to communicate since February 1st week. And we started working on this early on, looking at different nucleotide sequences of the virus. And there are subtle mutagenesis that there is in the virus. And all these different five areas that we looked at, we saw that it is not going to be an easy virus. It will have very high morbidity and mortality as it starts growing up. You know, looking at the travel patterns around the world, we saw that this would spread out quite fast, and we alerted almost everybody we could reach out to. Folks did not take it that seriously at that time, unfortunately, but regardless, we kept working on, and we developed a cure. We developed IP both towards, which could be useful towards a vaccine and the drug, and a drug, and a very specific drug to this, which is specific to the strain, as against the different repurposed drugs that are being used right now on the patients, which are, for example, the HIV drugs that are being repurposed and used. We have shown better efficacy and also toxicologically better, safer drug than others. We'll see how the lab tests come out. We have had some issues in getting the lab tests done on time. We've been ready since mid-March this is a real picture of the drugs that are ready. These are real products.
Okay.
So now finally, which we have a lab in the US which has approved the SRF and is testing these. So hopefully, you know, we keep our fingers crossed.
So the trillion-dollar question, obviously, is will we have a vaccine? And if so, when? And, you know, do you think people will take it? You know, what will be the efficacy of it and so forth? What are your thoughts on that?
So vaccines are a very important part, you know, from towards a very important prevention strategy across the world. But I think it is a little early right now to declare successes, as we are seeing from China, for example, on vaccine development. We do not know. We still do not know a lot of things. For example, we still do not know the animal source for this virus. And, you know, vaccines have different effects. So, you know, we would like to see the clinical results, the clinical trial outcomes. We focused on making the drug because we thought that is a better bet towards helping the patients, and also use it as prophylaxis. What prophylaxis means is, you know,
prevention.
Like prevention. Yeah, for prevention, it could perhaps be used. So all of this depends on how the lab results come, and we are waiting for that right now. Let's see how progresses.
Okay. Let's switch gears and talk about AI and humans and this idea of singularity a little bit. I've been fascinated by that discussion. Ray Kurzweil obviously is talking a lot about that, and he predicts singularity in 2030. Is he out of his mind, or is he right, or what do you think?
Well, I do not want to talk about people or their views. I have not discussed people. What I would like to say is, based on our research and our work, we think that humans can beat AI or be equal in performance. So there is something called a thalamic reticular nuclei and place in grid cells that exists in human brain. And, you know, that filters reinforcement learning for hippocampal development, not just in the first 2.5 years, but throughout life. So it constantly gives us new abilities if we can really harness that. So there is, you know, a hedging that brain does at the rate of 250 milliseconds per event. And that is a massive room for bionics, where we can improve our cognition to a level where we can beat AI systems on a volumetric comparison. If not, then we would be equal. So our research has discovered pathways on how we could achieve that. Of course, you know, there are brain-to-brain interfaces that exist in many countries, and there is there are systems that are already deployed. And, you know, how AI or the, you know, brain-to-brain interface-based systems would be used needs a mother of all regulations. There are so many things which are important in terms of privacy, which is fundamental. And this privacy is fundamental to freedom. Our hypothesis is that not just civilization 1.0, freedom 1.0 is equally important.
Yeah, no question about it. Elon Musk recently did that demonstration showing his Neuralink. What do you think about it?
Yeah, we worked on those things. You know, I was trying to prepare different research proposals towards my engineering doctorate way back in the year 2006 when I discussed with my potential advisors at UCL and with a couple of professors at Princeton University who I collaborated with. And that level of research is something that, you know, I had conducted at that time, you know, where you have those chip implants and through that you showcase a certain, you know, certain brain activity. We are far advanced as human race, I believe. Our work also has shown many advancements, and we are at a level where, you know, we can pretty much map the entire brain and that can be uploaded on a supercomputer, and, you know, the conversions can completely happen. So, you know, the brain-to-brain interface means that, you know, you or I could talk to each other, and that was the topic of my research, that you and I talk to each other, but we are really not talking. We are talking right through the brain-to-brain interface. Mm-hmm. Through our thoughts. And that is very much now possible. I think my work.
But it's not happening. I mean, we're not doing it now, so it's possible. But when do you think we'll actually be doing this?
If there is enough support, I think, you know, this requires support from governments, because this has a massive ethical dimension to it. You know, besides, that's the reason I talk about regulation. And therefore, the most powerful organizations of the government need to support. If those governments are willing to support, for example, like if the Indian government wants to support my work, then we may be able to deliver it to the government for permitted use purposes under law, or to the U.S. government, for example. I'm pretty open, of course, not to any other government in that sense, but, you know, because these are the two countries that, you know, stand for freedom, and freedom is very central to my approach to life, and I'm interested in exploring the journey of civilizations. So, you know, we're not just looking at now, but, you know, how could we really explore the civilization scales from 1 through 8? And mm-hmm. that requires a very important support within a government system to be able to carefully calibrate it. And this is deliverable. You know, we can deliver it now. It is not there in the future.
Okay, and what about quantum, combining quantum computing with AI?
Yeah, so eventually the most powerful convergence, the most powerful advancement of the human race would be the convergence of quantum and AI together, where we could become a completely working quantum machines ourselves as humans. What I mean by quantum machines is that not as in, you know, devoid of emotions, etc., but keeping all the human qualities at the same time, acquiring newer capabilities with quantum and AI. And that requires a fruitful and out-of-box interplay. You know, there is a very interesting work by a Texas teenager, you know, who made the recommendation problem algorithms obsolete from, you know, the quantum advancement in that field obsolete. By proving that a classical algorithm can overtake it. So if such work is given the opportunity, and we have done a little bit of work too, this kind of work can get into the mainstream, calibrated through government supports, we may be able to help through that advancement.
And just wrap this up for us, if you would. You started with the civilization grading, and let's just wrap up the whole discussion.
Yeah, sure. So whole idea that civilizations can exist at a certain energy scale is just one dimension to it. My hypothesis is that we have to be a very positive civilization. We have to be able to look at the enabling infrastructure around our civilization to really transcend into the civilization 1.0 and beyond. Otherwise, we fall prey to something I call an inverse Malthusian construct, which is about technology outgrowing human abilities, as against the 19th century construct of humans outgrowing agriculture.
Yeah. Malthus was an interesting economist, and I talk about him a lot. So how is this a reverse Malthusian? So instead of having scarce resources and too many people, what happens in this instance?
So in this instance, we risk self-annihilation if technology outgrows human ability, as against the Malthusian construct, which was humans outgrowing the means of, you know, food production or the agriculture.
Very interesting. And that is a risk many people are talking about. So we should all be concerned about it. Sanjeev, thank you so much for joining us. And do you want to give out a website, or I guess you've got your Twitter handle on the screen for those who are watching. Anything else you want to know or people to know?
Generally, we are media shy, but thanks for over 4 years of interest in our work. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience. I would just like to conclude with the statement that, you know, are we capable scientifically, technologically as humans to stop this inverse Malthusian construct and successfully transition into various levels of the civilization scale? The answer is yes, because we can beat AI. But are we capable of destroying ourselves in the journey? The answer is equally yes. Yeah. And that is where civilizational scale leadership is required across the spectrum, whether it's government, politics, or in private sector.
Very good. Sanjeev, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.